Last week we went through the three events that are mentioned in chapter 3. You remember, Habakkuk chapter 3 is a song that Habakkuk sings because the first part of the book is his, and we just always kind of keep going back and reminding ourselves of this, but maybe it'll help us remember what Habakkuk is that Habakkuk is grieved by the sin that he sees in his nation. So he responds by talking to God, "Why do you make me see this?" And God turns around and says, okay, I'm going to bring Babylon against you, the Chaldeans, and they're going to judge you. And Habakkuk thinks that's a little extreme. And so Habakkuk is in a state of real grief because here he realizes his people are bad, but he thinks the Chaldeans are far worse. And so he goes through, and there's a series of woes in chapter 2 with regard to the people of Babylon. And then he comes to chapter 3, and we talked about this last week, about the fact that when you are in a time where you're facing something really hard, it's difficult, something that God, obviously, something God's allowing you to be in, whatever that hardship might be. One of the most important things for you to be able to do is to worship God. And that's really what chapter 3 is. It is a song of worship. It's like a lot of the psalms that we have in the book of Psalms that goes through and talks about what God has done and uses that as an encouragement to think about, you've done this, now God, are you going to do something here in the future? That assures me that you are going to do something in the future. It's not a question, you are going to do something. So we looked at that last week, and we saw that there were three events in Israel's history that Habakkuk refers to. One of them, the first one had to do when God brought plagues and judgment against Egypt to deliver Israel from Egypt. The second one was when God dried up both the Red Sea and the Jordan so that Israel could cross. And remember his question in the middle of that chapter is, God, were you warring against the seas and the ocean and the rivers when you did that? No, God wasn't at war with the physical earth. It was with people, and he was using those aspects of the physical earth to accomplish it. And then the third thing that he mentioned was when God caused the sun and the moon to stand still in the sky. And those three things he uses to consider what God's going to do in the future. And so we're going to go back now, and I want to walk through these again, but I want to look at them. Last week we looked at what happened. Now this week we want to look at kind of stepping out of the context of Habakkuk a little bit to consider what God will do. And so the first one that we have here is when God brought judgment. If you're in Habakkuk chapter 3, it tells us in verse 3 that God comes from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. Those are places south of the land of Israel. But when Israel was in Egypt, God came from the north. And he came from the north against Egypt. And so it tells us in verse 5, before him goes pestilence and plagues follow after him. It's as though plagues are in his wake as he walks. So they see God marching from the north, coming down against them, and he's bringing plagues. Now, let's take a look at a couple of these things. I want you to, if you have a Bible marker here or something to stick here in Habakkuk, we'll be back to this passage. But I want you to flip over to the book of Exodus for a minute. And I want to look at a couple of the plagues just very quickly that God mentioned, and then we're going to look at some parallels. So we're going to start in Exodus chapter 7, verse 14. Exodus 7 and verse 14. This is the, interestingly enough, this is the first plague against Egypt. It's when God turns the water to blood, and it says in verse 14, and the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn, he refuses to let the people go. And jump on down to verse 19, thus says the Lord, verse 19, then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff, stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, over their streams, and over their pools, over all their reservoirs of water. So this isn't limited to just just the Nile here, that they may become blood, and there shall be blood throughout the land of Egypt, in the wood and in the stone. And the New American Standard has said vessels to clarify this. So God changes all the water down there in Egypt, changes all of it to blood. What's interesting is that the magicians, Pharaoh's magicians, come and they do the same thing, and you're thinking, well, that, so you're just making the problem worse. The magicians really could have done something, could have made the blood go away. But they didn't do that because they weren't capable of that. That's the first one I want you to see. And that's flood, and that's plague number one, and significance of plague number one, when he changes the water to blood here, is the Nile and the waters were like the backbone of Egypt. Okay. And so the very thing that was their lifeblood, as they saw it, becomes blood. Now, next one I want you to look at is in chapter 9. We're going to skip ahead a couple plagues for a reason. And in chapter 9 and verse 18, and it says, "And behold, about this time tomorrow I will send a very heavy hail, such as has not been seen in Egypt from the day it was found until now. Now therefore send, bring forth your livestock, whatever you have in the field, to safety, every man and beast that is found in the field, that is not brought home. When the hail comes down on them, they will die." And so he's going to bring hail. If you look down in verse 23, it says, "And Moses stretched out his staff toward the sky, and the Lord sent thunders and hail and fire rained down to the earth, and the Lord rained hail on the land of Egypt. So there was hail and fire flashing continually in the midst of the hail, very severe, such as had not been in all the land of Egypt since it had become a nation." So plague one was blood. This plague that we have here, and I don't have these numbered in my Bible, but this plague is a plague of hail and fire. Turn over to chapter 10. Look with me in verse 21. Let's go back up to Hebrews 10:13. Let's look at this one. What'd you say?
We're in Exodus, not
Hebrews. Exodus. Oh, yeah, Exodus 13. What did I say?
Hebrews.
Okay, I'm sorry. Exodus 10, beginning with verse 13. It says, "This is the plague of the locusts. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts, and the locusts came up over the land of Egypt and settled in all the territory of Egypt. And they were so numerous, there had never been so many locusts, nor would there be so many again. For they covered the surface of the whole land, so that the land was darkened, and they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. Thus nothing green was left on tree or plant of the field through all the land of Egypt." So we have a plague of locusts. Look down into verse 21. "And then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky, that there be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness which may be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward the sky, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the sons of Israel, there was light in their dwellings." There was a special exception made for where they were at. So we had four plagues we looked at over here. We had a plague of blood, plague of hail and fire, plague of locusts, and a plague of darkness. Now if you keep your finger in Habakkuk, now flip over to the book of Revelation.
Revelation,
yes. And turn to Revelation chapter 8. Now the first plague in this case is not the plague of blood that we have in Egypt. The first plague that we have in this case is in verse 7, Revelation 8:7. It says, And the first sound, these are the seven trumpet judgments. And so this is the first trumpet. It says, "The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up." So God is sending a judgment on the physical planet. We realize if we were to look at the, and I'm just looking at the trumpet judgments, but if we eventually were to go over into the last half of Book of Revelation under the bowl judgments or the vial judgments, this is going to be finished off. Start with the third, then it goes the whole thing in the next half. Okay? I'm going to make this is just pure conjecture now from Tim's point of view. Okay? So just take it as with a grain of salt. The first plague God brought on Egypt was a plague of turning the Nile to blood. Because what was the most important thing to Egypt? The Nile River. And I think when you come to the book of Revelation and the people that live on the planet, when the judgments of the Revelation come, they are called people who are settled down at home on earth. That's repeated over and over. It's as though earth is their home. And I think right now today we're seeing a variety of this that is really coming to the fore, where people are, not trying to get too political here, but essentially people are becoming real earth lovers. They're becoming the whole environmental green movement and all the things that are going on. It's showing you where this is going. So just as God brought the first plague on Egypt against the thing that was most important to them, God's first plague in this, it's not just the earth itself, but it's the green environment that God attacks first in this plague. And this is the last half of tribulation. First half we had minor, the beginning of birth pains, not the worst. Okay. Then we come to the second plague, verse 8 of Revelation 8. It says, "And the second angel sounded, and there was something like a great mountain burning with fire that was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed." And again, if we were to go to the last half, you're going to find out that God does it with all the waters and the fresh waters, just like, very similar to what God did with the first plague over there. So this is kind of the way these plagues start off. We had a plague of hail and fire in Exodus. We had one over here. We have a plague of waters being turned to blood. And that was in Exodus, and it happens over here. Okay. Jump down to verse 12 here. We're going to skip over the next plague, the next plague. We could actually look at verse 10 because it's going to affect the other waters. It says, "And the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. It fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters, and the name of the star is called Wormwood, and a third of the waters became Wormwood. And many men died from the waters because they were made bitter." We always have this expression, bitter, and as a kid, I could never understand that, because we would go to Minneapolis, St. Paul, to see my aunt and uncle, and when you drank water out of their tap, I always thought, this is the worst tasting water I've ever had, because it was city water, it was chlorinated like you would not believe, and it tasted horrible. And I could never wait to go home and drink our water. But then you'd go to my grandparents, who had well water, and the taste of their well water was kind of funny too, because it always had a real metallic taste to it that I didn't care. And my dad's brother's place, my uncle, we go to their place and their well water always had a real metallic taste to it. See? And so that's my idea of bitter water. It was water that you go and have someplace else, didn't taste good. I think we all understand, when it's talking about bitter water, what modern English word would we normally put in there to really give the point? Poison. Bitter water meant it wasn't good to drink. It's not just that it wasn't fit tasting. It meant it wasn't fit to drink. Okay. Now we come to verse 12.
Do you take that as the last part of verse 11 says many people died from the waters and become bitter or poison? Do you think that, I mean, this is conjecture too, I guess, but do you think that affects water under the ground?
I think it's talking about, it says there, a third of the waters became, verse 10, it says it fell on the rivers and the springs. So I think it's any type of naturally flowing water on the surface of the ground at that moment in time that God's, because it seems to be a contamination that comes as God drops something that affects the surface waters.
Right. Okay. I just wonder if, I hate to look at this from like a socioeconomic status. Seems like a lot of these plagues, I don't know, if you didn't have means to draw water from under the ground, you could be in trouble.
Well, and not only that, but you think even if you lived in a town like Royal City, or in most cities, they draw their water from underground, if you live in Seattle, their water comes from watershed, their water comes from reservoirs up in the mountain that goes down there and filters, and they may store them in water towers and things. Or in Royal City, we have water towers, but that's water above the ground. That's water that, even though it's above the ground and stored in a tank, could become contaminated, which means you're living in the city of Royal City, a lot of people would probably die because they would probably drink that water before they realized that they were drinking contaminated water. And when you see your children dying or your family dying around you or your neighbors dying, you all of a sudden decide, hey, we're going to quit drinking this water. Okay. You get that once in a while. That's one of the things you get when you watch the evening news once in a while. They say, so and such is the city, they got a water contamination thing, and they've got a boil order in place or a no drink order in place because they've got some sort of a contaminant that got into their city water source, things like that. I don't know if you realize this, but Stan Nelson will tell you, there's whole places that he used to go hike over in the mountains over where he grew up around Enumclaw. He says, you can't even get in there. It is a federal offense if you go into those places. You can be prosecuted because they are watershed areas that supply water for the city of Seattle, and they are so afraid of people getting in there and contaminating their water sources that they've got it fenced off, and they'll prosecute you if they catch you across the line. So I'm just saying, even today with the way we do it in a lot of places, our water sources really are very vulnerable to some degree. I mean, it wouldn't take very much to cripple Royal City in terms of our potable water that we drink. Go up and smash a couple of wells and they'd be down real fast. And you could damage those wells to the point that it would take a lot of work to get them up and running. Verse 12 then goes on, adds another one. It says, and the fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun and a third of the moon and a third of the stars were smitten, so that a third of them might be darkened and the day might not shine for a third of it and the night the same. And we find out in the last half, or as it goes on, and if we were again to jump over, Jesus tells us this over in Matthew, but also if we were to go over into the vials, that there is a plague of darkness where God causes the lights here to go a third and then all out. So that by the time Christ comes back, there is no light left. Okay. And then chapter 9. Chapter 9, beginning with verse 1. And it says, and the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key to the abyss was given to him. And he opened the abyss, and smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. And out of the smoke came forth, what does it say? Locusts upon the earth. And the power was given them as the scorpions of the earth have power. So they're something, they're locusts, that's what John calls them, are locusts, but I've never known a locust to have the stinging power of a scorpion, but these do. God can certainly do that. Here's the point. I took these four, actually five here in Revelation, and we saw that they parallel, in many ways, the plagues that God brought on Egypt, which is a reminder that when Habakkuk, if we go back over to Habakkuk, and he tells us in Habakkuk chapter 3, and verse 5, that pestilence goes with him and the plagues follow after him, that in the same way that God brought those plagues on Egypt, there is a time coming in the future in which God will bring judgment on the earth again, and he uses very similar plagues to what he did in the days of Egypt. And Habakkuk says that. So Habakkuk takes, think about this now, Habakkuk is taking comfort in this. This is a song of comfort and praise that Habakkuk is singing. God, this is who you are. This is what you did when you delivered us from Egypt, and this is what you're going to do again in the future. God, again, when God shows up again, he's going to do this. Now I want to look at one other interesting thing about this coming that he mentions here. He also says in Habakkuk 3:3 that he comes from Teman, which is a city in Edom. And if you'd flipping your Bibles over to the book of Isaiah for just a minute. And turn to Isaiah 63. When he comes in his judgment in the future, Isaiah 63, verse 1. Who is this who comes from Edom? Now, this is not the judgment that Habakkuk is talking about, where God was coming from the north, coming down from Edom, coming to Egypt. This is a future judgment in which God's coming against the land of Israel. And before he strikes Israel, he strikes Edom. He goes south and he hits Edom first. Then he comes up and it says, so who is this who comes from Edom with his garments of, and it tells you here, with crimson colors from Bozrah. Now, my Bible's translated this glowing, but it's the idea of crimson red. This one was majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Now he asks the question, why is your apparel? Now he switches from the word crimson to the word red, the word Adam. This is actually the word that Adam comes from, meaning that Adam probably had a very red complexion. And your garments like the one who treads in the winepress. Now, most of us, we're not used to people treading in the winepress, but you can imagine, you've all know what it's like when your kids have gone outside with their boots on and they find a mud puddle and they stomp in it. What happens? It's not just their boots get wet, they slop that stuff all up all over their clothes. And that's what happened when you treaded the winepress. He says, I have trodden the wine trough or the winepress alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I trod them in my anger. So he does this all by himself. No one's helping him. And I trampled them with my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained my raiment. So when he comes in judgment up to Israel, he has already marched and splattered his garments as if he was stepping on people as though he were stepping on grapes. And his garments are splattered all over the bottom with this. And this is coming from, it says in verse 1, from Edom. And Teman, in Habakkuk 3:3, Teman is a city in Edom that he came from. And when he came from there, he came to wreak judgment. And here, likewise, he's coming in judgment. And you're seeing the power of his judgment in the future because he's already destroyed a bunch of people. He's already stomped a bunch of people in doing this. Verse 4, it says, for the day of my vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption was come. So God is coming for, what's that word? For a day of vengeance. What's he avenging? He's avenging his people Israel, which is exactly what Habakkuk chapter 3 is about. It's about the fact that God used people that wanted to wage war, people that were aggressive, and he let them do what they wanted to do most. He even put it in their heart, although they did not think that. Remember, we saw that previously in Isaiah, where God says, It was in his heart, but it was not in his heart of himself. In other words, he did not think it up. God's the one that directed the heart of these Gentile rulers to go and do these. But there was also a point in which those Gentile rulers were doing, in one sense, what they wanted to do most. But then God turns around and judges them for this. Okay? Judges them for what they've done. We did look last week about the drying up of the Red Sea and the Jordan and what he was and how he was affecting that. We already kind of talked about that, and we talked about, just to go back and do a very quick review, if you turn to Isaiah 2, Isaiah chapter 2, in Isaiah 2, this is again this review from what we did last week, but just to remind you, verse 1, it says, in the word which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, that it will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established on the top of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. So we talked about this last week, that when God over there is talking about fighting in Habakkuk, striking against the mountains and the hills, he's looking at language in which God really does physically shake the earth and the mountains, but it also has a figurative sense, because mountains and hills were a picture of governments. And when it talks about here that God's going to put the mountain of the house of the Lord on top of, in verse 2, the other mountains of the world, it's obviously not that he goes and picks up the hill Jerusalem's on and goes over and puts it on top of K2 or on top of Everest. What he's saying is that he's putting that government above all other governments. There also, I think, actually is probably a very physical geologic feature in that. Towards the end of the tribulation, God is going to so violently shake the earth. And I just read this. I read this yesterday, I don't remember, but I didn't write the verse down for this one, but it says he's going to shake them. There won't be a mountain left. He's going to fill up every valley and shake low every mountain. So he's just going to kind of level the planet. But in doing that, he also then is going to take the mountain that Jerusalem sits on. He is going to raise it up. So there is a sense in which I think physically it will be higher. Believe it or not, that mountain physically will probably be higher, I would say, even than Everest is, because Everest is going to be flattened, which is really hard for us to imagine. But hey, that's a small thing for God. I mean, that's like take the thumb and push it down for God. It's no big deal. No big deal. Okay. Anyway, I could go on with. I can't help it. I was talking about her when she was little and stuff. And I remember when she was so little that she could sit, but she couldn't really crawl yet. And we would take, she had blocks, remember those little wooden blocks you'd get with the numbers and letters on them, and we would stack them up. She found out really early on the funnest thing in the world to do is to let Dad stack them up and then sit there and he'd be going, wait, Katie, wait. And she's sitting there, she's like, I can't wait anymore. And she'd reach out and knock them down. No big deal to her. Knocking down that tower of blocks, do it over and over again. That's like God, just to be able to take the mountains and just level them like that. Just no big deal. But even more so than the physical, geologic aspect of this is the fact that God's going to elevate these mountains above that. And then on top of that, when he talks about what he's doing with the seas and the rivers, that he did physically do that in the past. He is physically going to attack the seas and the rivers. We just looked at some examples of that a little bit ago. But even more so, we saw this last week, and again, I'm not going to go through all these verses, but we looked at about three passages last week that describe the nations as rivers and seas. And so I believe in the same way that mountains is looking at it as a reality, but also in a figurative sense, in the same way he's looking at the rivers and the oceans or seas, both literally and in a figurative sense. Some people say you can't do both. And I would say, I don't know why sometimes you can't have it go both ways. Why God can't say, I'm going to do a physical thing to show you another thing over here, to show you another reality in this regard. When he rides against these people, flip back over to Habakkuk now. Habakkuk chapter 3. Oops. Didn't get there. Habakkuk chapter 3. And come to verse 11, the sun and the moon, we saw this last week, stood in their places. It says, they went away at the light of your arrows, at the radiance of your gleaming spear. But it says, in indignation you did march through the earth, in anger you did trample the nations. Yeah. You did go forth for the salvation of your people, which is again then a reminder that ultimately God's purpose in bringing these judgments is to bring an end to unrighteousness in Jerusalem and in Judah and Israel. But it is also to save Israel and Judah. So it's a twofold purpose that God has. So we have here the salvation. And it pictures him as a soldier marching out before his army as he is marching in his wrath. Verse 12, his wrath, his indignation, marching through the earth and trampling these nations. So it's looking at God as this fierce warrior, looking at this God back in verse 11 as reaching up in there and pulling out arrows, but rather than just what we call a standard arrow to fit to your bow, it's an arrow of gleaming light. It's bright and brilliant in the way God comes against these people. And interestingly enough, when Jesus Christ comes back, Jesus Christ himself told us over in Matthew 24 that the sign of the Son of Man, he doesn't tell us what it is. We have to actually find it from other scriptures, but he tells us it's going to be something so plain no eye on the planet is going to see it, because it's like lightning that comes out of the east and goes all the way to the west. And what is it? It's the brightness of the glory of the Son of Man. Which, I wasn't prepared for this, but let's flip over to Zechariah for just a brief second. And let me give you this one in Zechariah. Zechariah, and you're going to have to, it's in chapter 14, and in chapter 14, notice how God does this. It says in verse 1, it says, behold, the day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you, for I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle. The city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. And then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on the day of battle. So he's bringing judgment, and he's bringing the judgment by bringing these nations against Jerusalem. And they are going to part, they're going to be fulfilling, finalizing the thing of removing all the rebels out of the nation of Israel, which we've looked at in other texts. But verse 3 then, in that context, God goes out to fight. So he's actually going to go out and do the fighting for them. We know God's done this before. We've reviewed one of those passages out of the book of Isaiah where in the days of Hezekiah, when Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, comes down against them, and he goes out and kills 185,000 Assyrian warriors in one night. See, so God can fight. He has done it. He certainly fought the Egyptians by drowning them in the Red Sea. What did the song that Moses and the Egyptians sang, the horse and the rider, they've been thrown into the sea. So God has done this. So it tells us here he's going to fight, but it's going to be unlike those battles that he's fought before, because in this battle, if you look in verse 9, it says that the Lord will be king over all the earth in that day. The Lord will be one, his name one. And then if you jump down, it says in verse 12, it says, now this will be the plague with which the Lord will strike all the people who have gone to war against Jerusalem. So when he actually goes out to fight against them, this is what he does. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongue will rot in their mouth. In other words, these guys are standing there to battle, and right there where they're battling, everything just like that, just deteriorates and they die, just falls, just like this. I don't know if any of you ever, one of my favorite movies growing up, Raiders of the Lost Ark, still have to go up to Dwight's, and I borrow that from him once in a while and go home and watch it. But that final scene where those guys are standing up there, and I don't know if Steven Spielberg took it out of this passage here, but to me that pretty close to what he's trying to indicate here about right there while they're standing on their feet, they're just flesh, as it were, just rots away, just falls right off them in that case. Which helps you understand why we're told in other passages that in that final battle that he wages with these people, the blood is going to run deep as high as the bridle of a horse. You can understand why that would happen. And what kind of battle would cause there to be that much carnage? Battle like this, where he just is going to cause it all to fall right off. And the thing is this is totally supernatural. I've read books and listened to people that have tried to explain these things by some sort of a bomb. I remember when Jim probably remembers this, but when we were growing up in the 80s, they were talking about trying to build a neutron bomb. Remember that?
Yeah, leaves the building standing and takes the people out.
And it would have done something. God doesn't need a neutron bomb. His presence, those people simply standing there present before him in his brilliance, is all that it takes. But back here in Habakkuk then.
That you just were sharing that second coming stuff.
Yes. Yeah, that is not something that has happened in the past. That is something that's going to happen when he comes to fight for them in the future.
Does that battle have a name?
That would be that actually would be the battle that would be Armageddon. Because that's that valley to the north and west of the city of Jerusalem. And we call it Battle of Armageddon because it's in the Hebrew, it's the Valley of Megiddo, and it's the Valley of the Mountain of Megiddo, because there's a mountain called Megiddo, and in the Hebrew, mountain is the word har, and when you bring it over into Aramaic and Greek, you mess it up, and they say, instead of har, they say ar, so it's Armageddo, Armageddon. So the Valley of the Mountain of Megiddo, and it's this big valley that hundreds of wars in history have been fought in that valley. It's a very famous battle plane.
What point is the earth flat?
Right here towards the very end. It's the shaking that God does. It's probably one of the reasons that they're fighting a battle in a valley, because a valley is a fairly safe place to fight a battle. When you've got the world being, or the earth being shaken, you don't want to be hiding inside buildings.
It's so, a weird deal. I mean, I trust God, but you know, you think about how today battles aren't fought like they were in biblical times. I mean, everything's technology-driven, and there's no mention of it. You know, even as reading past where you stopped, verse 15, it says, similar plague will strike the horses and mules, the camels and donkeys, and all the animals in those camps. Which I'm sure in biblical times, that was important, you know, your livestock. Today, we don't need horses or mules to help us wage war or move supplies. And obviously, God's going to wipe out technology in some respect to where they are going to gather in a valley.
I think he will. I think when you look at the severity of the 21 judgments we have explained in Revelation, and we know that there's another 7 that he tells us exist, but he doesn't tell us what they are. Yeah, I think God's going to devastate the planet to such a point. I mean, you have the things that are going on the planet to this degree. I could really see how what we consider oil production and things like that, how that's really brought almost to a standstill. Which is something we're always worried about. Isn't that something our nation's always concerned about? Is do we use our oil reserves? Do we keep them? We don't want to use oil reserves. And, you know, we got to keep expanding this. And now we've got U.S. Navy right on high alert over there because, remember, the Persians said they're going to shut down that inlet that goes through the canal that allows people to transport, what do they say, a tenth of all world's oil or something like that, or one-sixth, that's what it is, one-sixth. No, not Panama. I think probably over in the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. Navy is on it, because we're worried about one-sixth of the world's oil production being halted. Because we are aware, 1/6 is a big, that's a punch in the gut. And not a little one, okay? So yeah, I think God with his judgment is really going to, all the things that we take so much pride in as human beings, all the accomplishments that we, I can see how technology and modern science and things like that, how God can just devastate those quickly in this time. Because it's some of those things that have allowed people to say, we don't need God anymore. Look at all the things, all the problems we solved. We're not like those ignorant people that needed God in the past. Because we've built computers, you know. We've got things that fly us all over the planet. We can do everything. We've cured diseases, you know. And the arrogance of man. And what is it? A couple years ago, we were a little concerned about H1N1. And I just was reading again that the doctors say we still need to be very vigilant because the H1N1, they already have evidence that it has really begun to mutate. They have got mutated forms of the H1N1 that are out there. In fact, I think there's a doctor that they're trying to tell him to keep his mouth button shut because he has mutated a version of H1N1 exactly for the purpose of developing vaccines with regard to that, but they don't want it because they realize how quickly it could become a weapon and what's going on. So it's just human beings have a tendency to be very arrogant in the things we've done. Look at Nebuchadnezzar. Look at all these things I have done. Look at everything I've done. And like that, God could bring him low. And he was arrogant, and he didn't have what we would consider the technology we have today. He did incredible great things. But it's a good lesson. But that's a good point. Yeah, we have to trust God's going to do things at that time that, from our perspective right now, may not always make sense. Notice what he does when he strikes. Read verse 13. You did go forth for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You did strike the head of the house of evil to lay him open from thigh to neck, or foundation to neck. So it's as though he strikes him, and you think if you struck a guy and you took a spear, or you took an arrow, or you took a sword, and you jab a guy, that's a pretty nasty wound. But here he says this is like taking that, and from what does it say here? It says from thigh to neck. It's as though you stick it in there and rip him all the way out from top to bottom, which to us seems pretty gory, and we look at that and go, that's disgusting. But for people that lived in a warrior society where they were used to seeing people wield swords and spears like this, this was something that they can go, yeah, boy, you did that to a guy. You know, usually in battle, you had time to, you know, hopefully hack at a guy's neck or jab him good enough to knock him down, but to actually take him, just slice him right open like that, that's pretty serious. And it's showing how devastating God's attack is against them. He's just not Pokemon here. By Pokemon, I'm talking about a guy poking, not the stupid thing. I'm sorry. That was a bad illustration because it sounded weird. Anywhere. You did pierce with his own spears. And remember, what's the difference between a spear and a javelin? A javelin you threw, a spear was a sharp end on the end, was a sharp tip on the end of a pole that you'd poke. So from over here, you could poke at Ben and Jim without getting close enough for them to hit you with a sword. That was the purpose of a spear. You jabbed repeatedly. You didn't throw a spear. Okay? And so here it says, you did pierce with his own spears. In other words, God's going to turn their own weapons against them. The head of his throngs, they stormed in to scatter us, but their exaltation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. In other words, God's going to turn it back around against them. You did tread on the seas with your horses on the surge of many waters, which again I believe are references to what God's going to do, probably physically to the earth, but also even more so to the peoples. I heard then, he says here at the end now in verse 16, I heard and my inward parts trembled. At the sound my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones and in my place I tremble. Because I must wait quietly for the day of distress. Now what's the day of distress that he's waiting for? The time that the Chaldeans are going to come against them. He says, I'm going to wait for that. And he says, though the fig tree should not blossom, there's no fruit on the vines, the yield of the olive will fail, the fields produce no food, the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls. Yet I will exalt in the Lord, and I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. And we're going to stop there. He says, I know, God, and he's coming to a conclusion after he's reviewed what God's doing. He comes to a conclusion going, God, I know I'm going to have to wait for the day that you're going to bring this devastating judgment from the Chaldeans against us. But I also know that you're going to deal with the Chaldeans. That's been part of this song because he talked about this in these three vignettes from Israel's history. But on top of that, he's saying it caused him to shake. It caused me to quiver. And I realize that everything's going to go out of style here. But I want to take a look at just a few passages about what God told Jeremiah. And I want you to flip over to Jeremiah for a minute and turn to Jeremiah 29. Because Jeremiah and Habakkuk are going to find themselves in the same situation. Because they're living at the same time. They're contemporaries. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 1. It says, now these are the words of the letter which Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the rest of the elders of the exile, the priests, the prophets. Now this would have been people taken in the first deportation. Remember, there were three deportations. The final one is the one that leaves Jerusalem and the temple flattened for the most part. And so he's sending this to one of the early ones, which would have included perhaps Ezekiel, would have included Daniel and Daniel's three friends. So he sent these. And with that, then, I want you to look. Let's look at verse 4. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce, take wives and become the fathers of sons and daughters, take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands, that they may bear sons and daughters, and multiply there and do not decrease. In other words, don't just go over there and sit on your hands and feel sorry for yourselves. Go on with life in Babylon. Verse 7. And seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will have welfare. In other words, he's saying, don't go over there and mourn and complain and sit and pout and sit on your hands and think, oh man, did we get a bad lot. He says, seek the welfare. You don't normally do this. The people that take you captive, the people that capture you and haul you off, you don't usually pray for the welfare of those people. Now, have you ever thought about Paul? When Paul wrote in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that you're to pray for kings and for rulers and governors and such like that, about the way we might live lives that are silent, quiet, not argumentative or boisterous, and quiet and peaceable lives over there, that we might do that. What kind of nation was Paul writing that under? When he writes in 1 Timothy, who's in control? Who's the ruler? Does anybody know who the ruler was in Rome? Who? A very famous Roman ruler with bad reputation. Nero. Nero. Yeah. Nero's in. And he says, pray for these guys so that you go on living a peaceful life. Because the purpose of government out there is not to be moral. The purpose of government is to maintain order. That's the purpose. They bear the sword to keep order. In one sense, think about it. Most of you go to bed at night, you don't go to bed worrying that you're going to have bands of hordes that are going to come raiding through and are going to break into your houses at night and hold you all captive. I'm not saying things like that don't happen in the United States on occasion. But we don't normally worry about that because we have a sense of law and order. And this is what he's saying. You seek the prosperity and you seek the peace of the place I'm sending you. Because God was sending them there for punishment, but God was also sending them there to continue and perpetuate the people of Israel. And eventually bring them back. Okay? That's verse 10 here of chapter 29 in Jeremiah says, "For thus says the Lord, when 70 years have been completed for Babylon, I will visit you, fulfill my good word to you, and bring you back to this place." And remember, Daniel reads this, and Daniel was reading this in Jeremiah 70 years, and he's going to God, "When is that 70 years up now? I'm wondering about this." See, so this was something that was a hope for them. Live over there, seek peace, but realize there's a time coming in which it's going to be over, 70 years. I've got a number of other scriptures that could go along with this. But the whole point is, and we can flip back over to Habakkuk. If you flip back over to Habakkuk, and we'll kind of tie this off here tonight. His point that he was getting at is, you people are going over there for a reason. God's bringing judgment upon you, and it was going to be hard for Habakkuk. It made him shake. It made him afraid to think about the Chaldeans coming against him. But Jeremiah's prophecy also adds the assurance, you're going over there to be saved alive. So go over there and seek the peace of those people. And with Habakkuk's knowledge of who God is, Habakkuk ends this with a statement that maybe some of you understand or appreciate this better than I do. But it says, "The Lord God then is my strength." That's something we ought to be able to say, because he is the one, the Spirit in particular, is the one that gives us strength. Strength in the inner man, not physical strength. And I think even to some degree, however God did it, this was even true of Habakkuk, that God would have given Habakkuk some sort of a strength mentally here to mentally respond properly to what he had to do, to the prophecy he had to give, and to what he had to wait and see take place. But then he goes, "And he has made my feet like..." Now this is figurative, because literally Habakkuk's not going to do this. "But he's made my feet like hinds' feet, and makes me walk on my high places." Now David uses this expression. Three times we have this in the Old Testament, and twice it's David. Now David, I'm sure, saw this, and he knew what it was to see these hinds' feet. Because David was a man, especially when he was fleeing from Saul, spent a lot of time up in the mountains. And the hind, now there's some debate as to what exact creature this is referring to, but most of them believe that this was a small deer that lived in the backcountry, and it was a mountain deer. Now, I don't know if this mountain deer is like what we think of when we think of mountain goats. It's not the same animal, I'm saying, but if it's similar... It always amazes me, if you ever watch video of mountain goats, how those things walk along the side of a face of rock that you and I would be hard-pressed to even get a decent finger hold on. And they walk around it because God's given them a foot that grips that and allows them to walk and there with a balance. That's what these deer, and they have this species of deer over that land that lives in the mountains, and they do. They leap around on rocks. And I know what that's like. I'm a person, I don't, when I'm in a rocky area, I don't jump around from rock to rock like a crazy nut, because I've watched people do that, watch the rock roll, and they twist an ankle, or even worse, roll and then fall 20 feet, you know, because things aren't sure. But see, that's the thing he's saying. He's made my feet like those of a hind that jumps around, and they're sure and they're steadfast, and they move around up there, and they can flee and they can get away so quickly and with such ease because God's designed them to have these feet that move like this. And he says, that's what God's doing for me. But now, is it literally that Habakkuk's literally going to be able to just flee and run away from this? No. But God's given him the stability that those creatures had. And with that stability, Habakkuk is going to be able to face this coming challenge because God is his strength. And as a result, he makes me walk on high places, which is what those hinds would do. You don't see mountain goats walking in your pasture, do you? You don't see mountain goats coming down and walking in the easy ground. They tend to like to stay up in places where there's protection. Going up on the high places where they can easily have vantage of predators coming. And that is what he says, that's the way God's made me. God's made me one that's secure, like those creatures are secure. He ends this for the choir director on my stringed instruments, which again reminds us this was a song. Chapter 3 was a song. It's hard when you and I read this to imagine what it would have been like to sing this. It would have been interesting to hear what this sounded like when they sang this as a song. Some of it in Hebrew has a little bit of rhyme, but Hebrew poetry and what you had really had a lot more to do with rhythm and meter than it did with the sing-songy rhyme that we're so used to in our songs. And that even rhythm and such. But it was something that he put together divinely by the Holy Spirit on top of that, that they actually, that Habakkuk could have sung, could have played this on a stringed instrument. I don't know if you could take the English words of this and reconvert this into this. Ben, put this together for a song and lead us in Habakkuk chapter 3.
Yeah.
But if you stop to think about it, it's a good song to sing. Because it's a song that essentially says, you know what? We're facing a really tough time, but we've got a God that marched against Egypt. We've got a God that dried up the sea and dried up the rivers. And we've got a God that made the sun stand still. And he's a God that's going to march against the enemy. And he's going to wage war with the enemy, and he's going to defeat the enemy. He's not going to do it now, but he will in the future. Is there something you and I take away from that? We've done this in some of our other studies, but I just remind you of this. This is part of what Paul tells you in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, is one of the things that you need to do to maintain a proper attitude. Keep in mind, most true believers in the history of the church have lived in situations that have been, if not unfavorable to Christianity, have been perhaps overtly hostile. And yet Paul in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 reminds the believers that the fiery trial that you're going through is a reminder that God will bring fiery judgment against those people in the future. And when Christians in different parts of the world, or perhaps us, have to undergo that severity of judgment because of the way the world treats us, we need to be reminded that God will avenge us. And when we remember that he avenges us, it helps us to maintain the type of attitude, helps us to have patience under adversity, to remember that this will end, because maybe I'll die, and it definitely will end. Or it'll end when the Lord comes back, and the Lord will avenge me. Which some of us today would say, that doesn't seem very righteous that we should want that, but God never sees anything wrong. God says he's going to avenge. So God doesn't look at it as being wrong. In fact, interestingly enough, the word avenge in both the Old Testament and the New Testament is actually built on the word righteous. Which is, you don't see that in English. Vengeance for us doesn't seem very righteous, but for God it is. It's directly tied to the whole concept of God being righteous. He would be unrighteous to leave their evil deeds unpaid for what they've done. Any questions or comments as we tie off Habakkuk then tonight? Okay. Let's close. close with a word of prayer. Our Father, we are indeed thankful to be reminded of the God that you are, the God that Habakkuk reminded himself of, and then to retake that and understand, look forward even to some things that Habakkuk himself didn't personally know, as we're able to open the book of Revelation and have a glimpse at how indeed some of these things that you have done in the past you will repeat in the future, but with even more severity than you have done in the past, as you will bring about your righteousness and you will avenge those people that have been your people that have been mistreated, whether it was your people Israel or whether it's your people within the church. And you are righteous in doing so. And we're thankful then that you are our God. You are the God that is powerful. You are the God that understands all things. And you are the God in wisdom that knows exactly how to use your tremendous knowledge and power to accomplish your purpose in ways we could never comprehend. So we're thankful for this time together. Thankful for the God that you are. Amen.